Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about presidential power. And our guest for the show is Gene Healy. He's senior editor at the Cato Institute in Washington, D.C. He's the author of a number of studies criticizing executive power and the way that presidents of both parties have abused presidential power. And we'll be talking about some of the ideas that you will find in his new book. It's titled The Cult of the Presidency, and it's published by the Cato Institute. In this book, he makes the argument that even with all of the partisan bickering that goes on in Washington today, people both on the left and right can agree on at least one thing, and that is, in his words, the boundless nature of presidential responsibility. He says that no one, neither left nor right, sees the president as the framers saw him, as a constitutionally constrained chief executive with an important but limited job. He goes on to argue that few Americans find anything wrong with this idea that it's the president's duty to solve all of our big national problems and unite us all in the service of a higher calling. More on these ideas this morning as we talk with Gene Healy in this hour of Focus. Questions, of course, are welcome. Questions, comments are welcome from people who are listening. The only thing we ask of callers is that people are brief so that we can keep moving and get in as many as possible. But you're certainly welcome to call. Share your thoughts with us. Here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, you can give us a call. Our guest does a lot of interviews. He's appeared on both PBS and NPR. His writings have been published in a number of places, the Los Angeles Times, the Chicago Tribune, and elsewhere. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. By the way, also, you can find out more about the Cato Institute by going to their website, which is cato.org. Mr. Healy, hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. Just to start out here, certainly the Bush administration, this current administration, has been heavily criticized for taking this very expansive view of executive power. But right here at the beginning, I guess we want to say that you're being an equal opportunity critic here and saying that this expansion of presidential power did not begin with the Bush administration, and it is not something that can be laid exclusively at the door of Republicans.
No, I mean, in many ways, George W. Bush stands on the shoulders of past presidential giants with his claims of boundless executive authority. And, you know, it's I can criticize George W. Bush all day long, and I will if you let me, but the idea that that what's going on is unprecedented, I don't think will hold up. If you look at the abuses of executive authority in the Wilson administration, the FDR administration, the Truman administration, the Nixon administration, and on and on, I think what's particularly disturbing about the current controversies over executive power, however, is that, you know, we're talking about a war that's not going to end with a peace treaty in Paris. It's a potentially permanent war, and these are potentially permanent powers. So I think George W. Bush has made some extraordinary claims. There are claims that have some precedent, but maybe the context of the war on terror means we should be even more concerned about these claims than perhaps we have been in the past.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure we can talk about this in greater detail, but it is a way of asking two other kind of general questions about where responsibility lies. How much responsibility do you think lies with the Congress? And I'm not just talking about this particular one. I'm talking about the institution of the Congress having granted or responsibility of the president, or perhaps better to say that what the Congress has done is abdicated its own responsibility.
Yeah, absolutely right. It's a great point. Arthur Schlesinger Jr., the historian who wrote the book The Imperial Presidency, says somewhere in the book that you know, the story of the growth of presidential power is as much a story of congressional abdication as it is of executive aggrandizement. And you know, we've seen that in the Iraq War. The Iraq War resolution passed in October 2002 to authorize the war was really almost exactly like the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, in the sense that it was just Congress punting to the president, saying he has the authority to use all necessary and appropriate force. and individuals in Congress sort of denying that they'd actually voted for war. And the president, as in the case of LBJ and George W. Bush, 6-8 months later, with an intervening election, you know, chooses to use that authority. That's not the way the constitutional process is supposed to work. You know, Madison said that there was no part of the Constitution that had more wisdom than the part that gave the power of war and peace to the legislature and not the executive. And when Congress is able to pass these broad delegations of power and essentially say, you know, this is hard, you decide, then the system's not working the way it's supposed to. And, you know, sadly, individual members of Congress seem to be more interested in constituent favors than they are in being held accountable for the most important decision that any democracy can make. Mm.
And just to talk a little bit here also about the role of public expectations, certainly over time people have criticized particular presidents, and often I think the criticism is framed in partisan terms, or it's part of the partisan debate, and that is, well, if you have a Democratic president, then the criticism is going to come from Republicans, and if you have a Republican president, the criticism will come from Democrats. But you seem to be arguing that, largely speaking, that Americans are basically okay with this expansion of the presidential role.
Well, we have sort of a love-hate relationship with the imperial presidency. It's a like the title of that self-help book, "I Hate You, Don't Leave Me," and a big part of the book is to make the case that you know, if the presidency is too big, too powerful, and too menacing, we shouldn't be as quick as we might be to blame a particular party or a particular group of intellectuals, as much as to look in the mirror and say, what are we asking of the president? And, you know, there's a reason presidential candidates talk the way they do and promise the moon and embrace responsibility for everything from the unemployment rate to the state of spiritual malaise in the country. The reason they talk that way is this is what we expect. And this is not what the office was designed to do. The framers knew human nature too well to ever entrust one person with this much responsibility and this much power. You know, the president was supposed to be someone with an important job, but not someone who would bind up the nation's wounds. And amazingly enough, you know, I knew this, but when I got more into the research about the book, it was even more surprising that the framers, both sides of the early political spectrum, Hamiltonians and Jeffersonians, did not expect the president to have a public rhetorical role. They did not expect the president to pound the bully pulpit and try to move the masses to enact his program. They really saw the president as having more of a defensive role, to stop Congress when it got out of hand by using the veto power, or protect the country from sudden attacks. But they didn't think he would be this dynamic figure who was responsible for setting the direction of the country.
Yeah. I think, and certainly this may, you know, anyone who's an expert in American history can challenge me. It seems to me that in as much as in civics classes we've been taught this story that the idea was there would be these three branches of government, they would be co-equal, and that each one would function to limit the power of the other, I'm not certain that that's exactly what they had in mind, and it seems to me that in fact, they had in mind that the Congress was, yes, the three branches were equal, and yet the Congress was was intended to be the most important.
That's absolutely right. Yeah, the co-equal stuff does not come out of the Federalist Papers or the Constitution. I mean, Congress is in Article One. I think that's significant. The architecture of the Capitol with the comparing the Capitol building to the White House, I think gives you an idea of the relative roles these institutions were to play. I mean, Madison says in the Federalist Papers that in a small R Republican form of government, the legislature necessarily predominates. So they did actually think that that Congress would take the lead on policy matters and would take the lead on issues of war and peace. The president played an important role. Congress wasn't in session year-round, and of course, in the direction of a legitimately authorized war, you want to have one commander-in-chief. But it was not the case that we've gotten so far out of balance now that all eyes turn to the president whenever there's a national crisis, whether it's real or just perceived.
You make the argument that if you look back from that the original vision of the framers when it comes to the role of the president was what we had, roughly speaking, from the beginning of the country until about the beginning of the 20th century. That essentially it was what they had in mind, and this expansive executive started to in the 20th century. It was a 20th century phenomenon. Was there anything in particular that was going on at that time? We did obviously have a couple of wars, and we had a depression, serious issues facing the entire nation. That or anything else that would that and the growth of mass media would is that really what has contributed to the growth in the power of the presidency?
Sure, the mass media plays a huge role. I think perhaps even more the progressive ideology of the late 19th, early 20th century, which was really self-consciously opposed to the framers' system of checks and balances. The progressives wanted a lot of stuff done by the government, and they thought of the government as sort of a human body, and you shouldn't have Woodrow Wilson actually says this, you shouldn't have organs of the human body opposed to one another, so all the branches should be working together, and it should be directed from the center by the president. And they were also opposed to the rhetorical traditions of the 19th century, where there was a certain reluctance on the part of sitting presidents to campaign, and there was a norm that the office of the president of the presidency of the United States was something that was to be neither sought nor declined. So the progressives wanted a very public president. They wanted a president who would be a dynamic national leader. Herbert Crowley, the first editor of the New Republic, who was a leading progressive, called Teddy Roosevelt a sledgehammer in the cause of national righteousness. And this is how the progressives saw the presidency. And they were also pretty savvy about the fact that you would need a series of crises to really overcome Americans' latent hostility towards centralized power. And, World War I, the Great Depression, and World War II, combined with the presidencies of early on TR, but then particularly Woodrow Wilson and FDR. By the time FDR administration is over, you have a fundamentally transformed office where people look to the president for goods and services and benefits that they had not looked to the presidency for before the early 20th century. So I think you have presidents that were very significant, took broad unilateral action in the 19th century. But I think the office is fundamentally transformed in the early 20th century, and transformation is completed by the end of World War II.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Gene Healy. He's senior editor at the Cato Institute in Washington, D.C. He's the author of the recent book, The Cult of the Presidency. The subtitle is America's Dangerous Devotion to Executive Power. It's published by the Cato Institute. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We'll start out here. We have a number of callers. We'll start in Champaign County, here where we are. This is line one. Hello.
I have a prompted me to call is I'll set aside for just a moment because I'm not particularly fond of TR, but I thought Populus was suggesting that he was good at wielding a sledgehammer. I think he was plauding him for directing it at corporate power and the robber barons of that era. And it seems to me that libertarians always, have this myopia towards corporate power and focused entirely on government power. Now, state capture is such that corporations and governments are intertwined so much these days, and probably in those days too, that you can't really parse them out as well as I see a lot of libertarians doing. But anyway, you'll have a comment on that, I'm sure. But the idea that it's not fundamentally different now and all these presidents, all presidents have pushed executive power is true to some extent. But I would cite another conservative, Bruce Fein. He's got a book coming out called Constitution in Peril. And he testified at the last Friday's not very well reported impeachment, impeachment light hearings, I guess we could call it, and points out that this administration just baldly says that they don't have to deal with constitutional constraints and that sort of thing. I think he's written a play, actually, also about the impeachment of Bush. And they also bring up the fact that one of the constitutional powers that is suspended by impeachment proceedings, and this is a bit of a digression, but is the pardon power. And apparently there's a lot of agitation for blanket pardoning inside of the Bush administration. If articles of impeachments are drawn up, the subjects of that issue of what relates to those, pardon is suspended, apparently. So we won't have a record-breaking pardoning like we did during Bush 1 if a few articles of impeachment were drawn up and that right was suspended. I've always been in favor of it rhetorically, and I think it would be a great idea to impeach the president, but now I see something that would actually have an effect right now in the last days of this, I think, beyond the pale imperial presidency, if you will, sir.
Well, on the point about corporate power, I think it's right that to be for capitalism and to be for big business are two fundamentally different things, and big business is not necessarily for capitalism. We've published quite a bit on getting rid of corporate welfare, special subsidies for large corporations, and I think we may disagree on some of the details, but I in principle I certainly agree that big business is not always fond of open competition and free markets, and so I think it's a mistake when people identify libertarianism or support for free enterprise with support for large corporations as large corporations. So that's what I would say about that. As far as the details of the pardon power, I know certainly the president can't pardon himself from an impeachment proceeding or impeached officials. I do not actually know. I cannot say one way or the other about the other issue, but that's interesting. I'll look into that. And yes, Bruce Fein is a former Republican Justice Department official whose Republican credentials are pretty much impeccable, and he's done some really good work. He's been really incensed by a lot of what he's seen come out of this administration. And I do agree that there are aspects of the Bush theory of executive power that at least are more baldly stated and dramatic than what we've seen before. I mean, certainly John Yoo and the torture memos, where the theory is essentially that the entire world is a battlefield. On the battlefield, there's one commander in chief, and there can be no interference by any court of law or by Congress. That's a extraordinarily stark theory. They haven't pushed that theory as far as it might in actual practice, as far as its implications would allow. But I agree that this is a disturbing theory of limitless executive power.
Yeah, it's not just John Yoo as a theorist. I mean, Cheney, you can even cite his work in the Iran-Contra Minority Report, where he contests the whole ability of the premise of the investigation, that the investigation shouldn't have even happened.
Right. He said that he said that the whole theory can be found in that Minority Report, and for 30 years he's one of these people who thought that we made the country made a terrible mistake after Watergate in restricting executive power, and he's been for 30-some years pushing that, and that's had a lot to do with what's happened. Interestingly, you know, this didn't used to be the conservative line on executive power. If you go back to the mid 50s and the intellectuals who coalesced around William F. Buckley's National Review, they associated strong presidents with activist liberalism, and so you had a lot of critics of the imperial presidency in the conservative movement early on. You can find quotations by Barry Goldwater that would get Sean Hannity to suggest he should be locked up for treason, you know, if anyone made these statements today. And I think what happened, one of the things the book does not play favorites and does not take either side of the political spectrum. But one of the things I did hope to do in the book is to show conservatives, people who might be sympathetic to someone like Bruce Fein. I mean, Bruce Fein already understands this, but to show conservatives that the conservative heritage is not one of the divine right of kings, and it's really been ideologically hijacked by people like Dick Cheney and John Yoo, and this is not what either conservatism or liberalism should be all about.
We're already at our midpoint here. I want to thank the last caller and go on and pick up another caller here. This is someone who is listening in Champaign on our line 4. Hello.
Yes, I want to comment about the power of the presidency. If you go back to President Polk with the Mexican War and how that was pretty much ramrodded through, although the Congress approved it very much like they did with the Iraq War, it was definitely a presidential decision that started that, and I think there was probably a similar action in the Spanish-American War. But I think that the press and the general approach of the people in a particular time and emotional reaction dictates a lot of whether or not the presidency uses these times to their advantage, and I think I'd like to hear your comments about that.
Well, first of all, I think you make a good point. I address this in the book about the sort of 19th century predecessors to the modern imperial presidency. Polk is a good example. Polk is someone who showed that the fact that army command and the power to authorize war were separate left the president a lot of room for mischief, because Polk, you know, sent American troops into disputed territory, they were fired upon, and then he had a pretext for the war that he wanted with Mexico. There are other examples of presidents using tremendous power. You have Lincoln. Andrew Jackson introduces the argument that the president is the tribune of the people and has a special relationship with the people, and therefore should be considered, in some sense, more legitimate than Congress. And so you do see this, but you also see very few Americans can name all the presidents from Grant to McKinley, because we pretty quickly settle back into an era of congressional dominance. As far as the role of the press, yeah, I wish in the Iraq War, I wish there had been more mainstream attention to some of the doubts that people should have had about that war. And so sometimes the press does fall down on the job. But I would also place an enormous amount of blame on Congress, as I mention in the book and discuss in the book. There's a lot of people in Congress couldn't even be bothered. The overwhelming majority in Congress actually couldn't be bothered to read the National Intelligence Estimate on Iraq that was prepared in October of 2002. And, you know, if you can't be bothered to find out about the war that you're about to authorize, or even structure the authorization in a way that's a direct up or down vote on war or peace, then You know, you've got to give Congress at least as much of the blame, if not more, than you do the media.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Gene Healy. He is a senior editor at the Cato Institute in Washington, D.C. They've been around now for more than 30 years, generally considered to have a libertarian orientation. And he is the author of a book that's titled The Cult of the Presidency, America's Dangerous Devotion to Executive Power. It's published by Cato. He's authored a number of studies looking at executive power abuses by presidents of both parties. He's appeared on PBS, NPR. His writings have been published in a number of places, including the Los Angeles Times, the Chicago Tribune. He's a graduate of University of Chicago Law School. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And again, questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I'm sure, again, as previous caller said, and as a lot of other people, I think, would argue that the current administration, the Bush administration, has taken this to the highest point that it's been, that is the expansion of executive power. I was interested in having you reflect a little bit, though, on Harry Truman. I don't know that we would necessarily think of him as being someone who expanded presidential power, but he did, in fact, do that. Let's talk about Harry Truman.
Absolutely. I think Harry Truman expanded executive power dramatically, and it's a black mark on the historical rankings that he does as well as he does when historians and presidential scholars are polled. Harry Truman initiates our first major undeclared war, the so-called police action in Korea, and he claims the power in 52 to seize American companies and nationalize them as a matter of national security, and gets rebuked by the Supreme Court. He also, there's an episode in, I think it was 46, that I briefly mentioned in the book, where there are striking railroad workers, I believe it was, and he gets angry that they're striking, and he tells his attorney general to draft legislation that would conscript them into the army, just the people who are striking. And when the attorney general balks, he says, Truman says something to the effect of, you know, we'll draft them and we'll worry about the law later. I think he had a really unrestrained attitude, imperial attitude toward executive power. I think people like him because he was plain spoken and cut an appealing figure. But I think he was not somebody who was a good steward of constitutional authority.
Let's talk with someone else. Edgar County is the next caller on our toll-free line. This is line 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to quote from a speech which was made in 1964, which I think kind of takes the air out of the Republican ideology today. It was a speech which a person by the name of Ronald Reagan gave in the campaign for Goldwater. And he said that there was no left or right, but only up or down, and that the ultimate in freedom consisted with law and order, or down was the ant heap of totalitarianism, and regardless of their sincerity, their humanitarianism motives, those who would trade our freedom for security have embarked on a downward course.
I think that is, it's funny that you quote that speech, because I quote a different part of that, the exact same speech. That's from the famous televised address by Reagan on behalf of Goldwater. And it's a speech that conservatives love to quote. But there's actually I love the passage you quoted. There's also a passage in there where Reagan specifically criticizes theories of broad presidential power. He takes Senator Fulbright to task in that speech. And I just found the part in the book where I quoted it. Reagan says, so I'll just read it. It's only a sentence or two. Reagan says that Senator Fulbright, he had said at Stanford University that our Constitution is outmoded. Fulbright referred to the president as our moral teacher and our leader, and said he is hobbled in his task by the restrictions and power imposed upon him by this antiquated document. He must be freed, Fulbright says, so that he can do for us what he knows is best. And Reagan identifies this in the speech as one as the kind of philosophy, it's one of those things that would lead us down to what he calls the antipode of totalitarianism.
Right.
So here is here's Reagan, you know, at least before he became president, just excoriating this idea that the constitutional restraints have to be lifted from the president so that the president can protect us and lead us and do good things for us. That used to be, you know, there was always some tension with the conservatives' position in the 50s and 60s with the Cold War and their distrust of strong executives, a lot of tension. But you used to hear fairly frequently from conservative circles critiques of an overweening presidency. And, you know, maybe we'll, when they're out of power again, we'll hear that and they'll rediscover this heritage. But you'd like to think that these are not red team, blue team issues. These are timeless principles.
Well, that's what Reagan said. It's up and
right.
down. Also, a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but I'd like to quote something that John Adams said. He said, "In my many years, I've come to the conclusion that one useless man is a shame, two is a law firm, and three is a Congress."
All right. Well, I thank you for the quote.
Right.
Our guest this morning, again, is Gene Healy. He is a senior editor at the Cato Institute. He's author of the book, The Cult of the Presidency. It's published by Cato. We have somebody else here. Just quickly, you certainly make the point, and I think that people will realize that periodically when historians are polled and asked to rate presidents, and they do, that the presidents that they're likely to give the highest marks to may well be the presidents. I'm sure they are the presidents on your list of those who have expanded presidential power and expanded the role. They think of the people who have been presidents at very difficult, dangerous, challenging times, and those who have risen to the occasion. So the people on their list will certainly be people like Abraham Lincoln and maybe Teddy Roosevelt and Franklin Roosevelt and possibly Harry Truman. I wonder how you think about that and the fact that then people who maybe were the more of the quiet people who were just chief executives who thought it was their job just to keep things moving smoothly and not to have any big problems. How do you think about that?
Yeah, I think a great example of that, there is, as you point out, a bias toward activism, a bias toward people who, quote-unquote, leave the office stronger than they found it, and a bias toward war, frankly. You know, I think a perfect illustration of that is the relative historical position with Woodrow Wilson and his successor, Warren G. Harding. Wilson is routinely in the top 10 in these presidential polls. Harding is last or next to last in almost everyone that's been done. Wilson was a monster, got us into an unnecessary war, carried out probably the most severe crackdown on civil liberties in American history, was a racist, a segregationist, and just a power-hungry, all-around, terrible, terrible person. His successor, Warren G. Harding, was, presided over the beginning of the Roaring Twenties, got rid of a lot of Wilson's command economy imposed during World War One, and was also something of a civil libertarian. He freed a lot of the political prisoners that Wilson had locked up, including the perennial presidential candidate Eugene Debs, who was in jail for, I believe, a sentence of 10 years because he'd given a speech praising someone else who'd made a speech questioning the draft. So, you know, Wilson was a horrible person, and Warren G. Harding goes down in history because, A, he didn't do much and is remembered for the Teapot Dome scandal. It goes down in the history as one of the worst of our presidents. But, you know, the Teapot Dome scandal didn't kill, tens of thousands of people. I don't really, it's a black mark on Harding's record, but it seems unusual for there to be this disparity between presidents who respect the Hippocratic oath of the presidency, first do no harm, and presidents who blow a lot of stuff up, who tend to be rewarded by historians and presidential scholars.
Let's take another caller, and this is someone in Decatur, line number one. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Yes.
Sir, I was going to ask you about Woodrow Wilson, specifically some of his abuses, and you just covered that. Was he also kind of led around by a gentleman named House?
That's Colonel Edward Mandel House. I believe it was his consigliere, more or less. Yes, he played an important role in the Wilson administration, and I believe he's the guy who wrote the book Philip Drew Administrator, this progressive novel. It's actually a terrible, terrible novel, but it shows some of the ideas that were circulating in progressive circles at the time, which, you know, it's a fantasy novel, sort of a utopia or a dystopia, depending on your perspective, about a figure who emerges at the top in a modern American Civil War and institutes a number of progressive command economy policies and directs everything from the center. So there were a lot of, and not just in the Wilson administration, this was a time where a lot of the intellectual elite had repudiated many of the framers' ideas about skepticism toward power and really wanted dynamic, energetic government led by a dynamic, energetic president.
You may remember that quote. I wish I did. I think Wilson was writing maybe in the 20s when his head was clear, and he mentioned he wasn't too thrilled about the Federal Reserve Act that he's sort of signed, and maybe about the power, about consolidating power. There was a quote there, and maybe you could mention
it. I'm not familiar with that quote, actually. I know he played a key role in getting the Federal Reserve Act passed. But he was also, in addition to being important to the presidency as a president, he's also enormously important as a theorist, you know, as a president of Princeton University and a very successful political scientist. He wrote a couple books that I quote from in the in my book about what the framers had gotten wrong, and the second of the books, Constitutional Government in the United States, about the role that the president should play, the much greater role that the president should play in the American system of government, a greater role, as he admitted, than what the framers envisioned. And he really got to put that into practice. I think, perhaps even more than FDR, Woodrow Wilson was the pivotal president for the shape of the modern presidency.
All right. I want to thank the last caller and, again, talk with someone else here in Urbana. This is line two. Hello.
Hello. I would probably agree with much of what you said about Wilson. I'm not sure that you can justify that and making Harding a great president. After all, he presided over one of the more corrupt administrations, although he may personally not have been corrupt. There's one point about Harding that you perhaps should mention. His grandmother was black, or at least of mixed ancestry. And so while we have a campaign in which one candidate is said to be potentially the first black president, we've already had one.
Well, that is rumored about Harding, and it was, there were charges. I forget the name of the fellow who wrote the book. There's a piece in the New York Times about this recently. But I've talked to a Harding scholar about this. From what I understand, we don't actually know for a fact whether Harding had African American ancestry. He said himself that he didn't know, but whether he did or not, I don't think is that important. He did one thing I should have mentioned is he went to Birmingham, Alabama, early in his administration and made a speech against lynching, which doesn't sound like much political courage today, but was the first of its kind for the time. Yes, Harding's, though Harding himself was not personally corrupt, his administration was corrupt, and nobody likes corruption. But I think placed against unnecessary wars, political prisoners, a massive crackdown on civil liberties in the United States. I think whether you agree he should be a top-ranked president or not, I think he should come out ahead of Woodrow Wilson.
I would not argue that.
Okay.
And actually, it seems to have been an open secret in Cleveland that Harding did have mixed ancestry, and I certainly don't offer that as criticism.
No, of course not.
In fact, in a way, I guess it speaks to the character of some of the people of Cleveland. But at any rate, perhaps we shouldn't pay so much attention to Obama's ancestry at this point. Thank you.
All right, thank you. We're to the point here, we have maybe about 6-7 minutes left. Other countries, those countries that have parliamentary systems, have a head of government and they have a head of state, and they're two different people. The head of state often is symbolic, but you know, from time to time, you need someone to fill that kind of role. Do you think that I wonder whether this expansion of executive power in part is an artifact of the fact that we expect one person to fulfill both of those roles?
Yeah, I think that's I actually wanted to get more into this issue towards the end of the book, but didn't have the opportunity. But there have been people who have said that some of the seeds of this were in the actual design of the presidential system. There are aspects of a parliamentary system that, as someone who favors separation of powers, I don't care for. I don't like the unification of legislative and executive authority. You could also say, though, that had we had a Westminster-style system, George W. Bush would not be the head of government right now, he would have failed a vote of confidence. But yeah, there is, certainly many observers of the British and the American scene have commented on the fact that nobody really looks to the Prime Minister as the guardian of the national soul. I mean, nobody really thinks Gordon Brown is responsible for England, for the national spirit of England. Perhaps I've also there's been some academic work suggesting that some of the problems in Latin America have come from the adoption of the presidential system, because many of the countries have modeled themselves on the United States Constitution, and that the presidential system itself lends itself to this sort of cult of personality. Those are interesting ideas to explore. I think there may be something there, but for sure, we do invest more of our hopes and dreams and expectations and more power than we ought to in any one man.
Yeah. Well, and certainly that's as much as one might think that your representative in Congress or in the Senate would be a good and effective person, he or she is actually only one among many. And perhaps it's tempting to be able to concentrate on one particular person who does seem to have more influence and more power, more potential to get things done than any other individual.
Yeah, and a couple of callers have mentioned the media, I think, and there's something to that, and it's not a sinister example of media bias, but when I would gather when you're a broadcast news reporter, you want a character in the story, and it's better one than 535. Perhaps the broadcast media really do lend themselves to, whenever there's a high profile national incident in the country, whether it's a hurricane or a school shooting, the camera turns to the president, even though he may or may not have constitutional authority in some of these areas.
Well, given that the thing we're talking about here, the expansion of executive power, has been going on for a while, and that there have been a number of individuals who have contributed to that, particularly in the 20th century, but we've named at least one that came before. What now would you suggest that we do, or what do you think could be done to try to, in your words, and to bring the power of the presidency back more in line with what the people who put the government together in the first place had in mind?
Well, I wish I could say that there's, you know, often people want a five-point plan for doing something like this, and I don't think you can design statutes that are necessarily going to put the presidency back in its proper constitutional place. I think the way we look at the presidency has to change, and I at the end of the book I try to tell the good news. I mean, we've come a long way in, believe it or not, when you take a longer historical perspective, in how we view the presidency. The level of trust in the office and trust in the federal government that prevailed prior to Vietnam, Watergate, and the revelations of intelligence abuses by the Church Commission Committee in the 70s really changed the way we look at the president. And there's less reverence for the office. The late-night comedians feel free to ridicule the president mercilessly, sometimes like at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, to his face. And so that there really is less trust in government. And in many ways, we ought to be, it sounds odd to say, but we ought to be happy at how quickly, it didn't go far enough, but how quickly the courts and Congress reasserted themselves after September 11th. You know, there has been pushback. There has been more pushback than I think there would have been in the 40s had someone managed to blow up, kill 3,000 Americans in a surprise attack on American soil. And in many ways, the country, there are some trends in the country that are moving in a positive direction, where, claims of unchecked presidential power cannot prevail over the long term. I think what has to change and what hasn't changed is, even though people distrust the presidency and have that healthy skepticism towards power that animated the country's founders, they still ask for all manner of benefit from the office, and they still blame the office holder for everything from hurricanes to unemployment to just a general sense of national loneliness. So I think there is no easy answer. I do think that people, we need to change the way we look at the office. And one thing I would like to see is for voters themselves, because it has to come from voters, to actually hold congressmen accountable, not simply for how much pork they bring back to the district, but on grave issues like war and peace. Until individual congresspeople can expect to lose their seats sometimes for dodging these fundamental questions, I don't think we'll have fixed the problem.
Real quick, we'll try to get one more caller here on a cell phone, line 4. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, it's Colin. Seems like on the local level, whether it's municipality, county, even the state, there seems to be this prevalence to go to the executive to get something done rather than the whole body that represents the area. I'm from Kankakee, Illinois, so that might be one of my influences. But my observation shows that, is this something that has kind of grown up into the national level, too? Because, and the other question would be, is this expansion of presidential power an example of a failure of the experimentation of democracy because of their, you know, let's go to the one individual rather than dealing with the representatives of all.
Mr. Healy, I can give you about a minute to say what respond however you'd like.
Well, the question of state versus national, it may be a trend that's going on even at state and local level that's turning towards executives. It's more concerning, though, when the executive you turn to has the control of the world's most powerful army plus nuclear weapons. So it may be an ongoing trend, but I think it's of the utmost concern when we're talking about the presidency itself.
And not an indication of the failure of democracy?
Well, it's an indication of we're not supposed to be a direct democracy, and the framers distrusted many of the aspects of direct democracy, among them demagogic leaders. So what we really want is a republic, and a republic has rule by the people, but it has features that cut against this centralized, overarching presence by one man who's supposed to fix all your problems.
There we will have to leave it. If you want to read more on the subject, you could look for the book we mentioned a couple of times. The title is The Cult of the Presidency, America's Dangerous Devotion to Executive Power. It's published by the Cato Institute. And our guest, Gene Healy, is senior editor at the Cato Institute in Washington, D.C. And if you'd like to find out more about Cato and what it's all about, and you have web access, go to their website, which is www.cato.org. Mr. Healy, thanks very much.
Thanks a lot.